We're not sure what happened in this incident. That would be part of the investigation.
Trouble at the Spring Creek Prison. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 6th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, looking for clues in glacier ice cores.
That will allow us to predict how much they're going to melt back in the future, and therefore how much they're going to contribute to global sea level rise.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The State Department of Corrections is reacting to what is described as a disturbance at Spring Creek Correctional Center in Seward late last night. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, details about the incident at the state's maximum security prison are sketchy.
14 maximum security inmates at Spring Creek Prison in Seward were involved in what authorities are describing as a disturbance between midnight last night and 8 this morning. Casey Schroeder, a spokesperson with the Department of Corrections, says the incident is under investigation by DOC and the Alaska State Troopers.
We're not sure what happened in this incident. That would be part of the investigation. I would check back in maybe 3 weeks.
Schroeder says the inmates were all in individual cells in the segregation unit of the prison. She can't say how they contacted one another, but all of them remained in their cells at the time of the disturbance.
Nobody left their cell.
No injuries have been reported as a result of the incident. Schroeder says corrections officers have removed all the prisoners involved into a different segregation unit as of this morning. The prisoners will face disciplinary action and possible new charges. According to Schroeder, a prisoner is confined in a segregation unit depending on behavior, not on the seriousness of the offense. In this latest incident, damage to the prison was limited to some of the toilets in the cells, flooding of cell floors, and broken glass. Officials are cleaning up the mess. Spring Creek is the state's maximum security facility and houses 315 prisoners. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Brad Wilson with the Alaska Correctional Officers Association in Anchorage says the disturbance at Spring Creek was related to understaffing and mandated shift changes at the prison. In October of last year, a corrections officer at Spring Creek was attacked by inmates. A federal judge has determined that Shell's spill response plan was sufficient during its failed 2012 Arctic drilling campaign. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the ruling is a blow to a host of environmental groups that had looked to hold the federal government accountable.
Shell's 2012 campaign was not short on mishaps. A rig that ran aground, a failed test of spill containment systems, and small punishments from the government, including a ban on drilling deep into hydrocarbons. The Department of Interior allowed the company to proceed with pilot hole drilling despite not having a system in place to contain a worst-case scenario oil spill.
We have both a government willing to accept corporate assurance and a company that clearly is not prepared for the Arctic.
Michael Levine is an attorney with Oceana, one of the groups in the suit. He says the government should have forced Shell to file an environmental impact statement for its Arctic plan. The judge ruled that Shell does not need to submit to the EIS process. Congress would need to rewrite the laws to require that.
The government argued, and the judge agreed, that in approving a spill plan, the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement has to do little more than check off on a list that Shell has particular equipment. It doesn't have to decide whether it might actually work, whether those technologies have been tested or might do the things that the company says they will.
Shell declined to speak on tape for this piece, but in a written statement, a spokesperson said the company welcomes the news. Shell suspended its Arctic campaign after last year's blunders. The federal government then released a report increasing expectations for any future drilling companies in the Arctic. Shell has not specifically said when it will return to the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. The groups could appeal the ruling to the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
5 years of planning went into a drilling project in the heart of the Alaska Range. The scientists involved weren't drilling for oil, however. They are part of a team studying glacier ice to better understand how the climate has changed over the last 1,000 years. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
Dr. Eric Osterberg is an assistant professor of earth science at Dartmouth College. He and a team of professors and students from Dartmouth, the University of New Hampshire, and the University of Maine spent a month and a half drilling on Mount Hunter this summer in order to obtain glacial ice cores from as far down as 700 feet. The samples were obtained using a solar and wind-powered drill and were then packed and flown out of the mountains. The ice will be used to study past, present, and future climate change. Osterberg says that Central Alaska has been warming, both due to natural cycles and greenhouse gas. He says that some of those natural cycles are decades long, meaning that weather records, which only go back for about a century, don't provide enough historical data.
We really need these ice cores to get further back in time to understand both how the climate cycled naturally in the past, but also what caused those cycles. And that puts us in a much better position to understand what's happening there today, which is pretty dramatic in some cases, and some of the most dramatic warming that we're seeing anywhere in North America.
To better understand the cycles and patterns that control Alaska's climate, Osterberg and his team will be carefully analyzing the ice cores to observe past periods of climate change, such as the Little Ice Age. He says the ice has layers, much like the rings on a tree trunk, that help determine how old each core sample is. The team will also be studying the ice on the molecular level to determine what, other than water, is present.
So our specialty is looking at the chemistry of the ice in the core. And so that includes anything that falls on the glacier, like dust or like volcanic ash or sea salt that's blown up from the Gulf of Alaska in these storms. And so we can see how much of that fell onto the glacier in the past. And that tells us, for example, how strong those storms were. There's a very good relationship between how strong the storms are that are hitting Talkeetna and how much sea salt is getting blown in.
Osterberg hopes the team's research into the history of natural climate cycles will give them clues as to what controls them and what impact continued natural warming, as well as greenhouse gases, will have in the future. In addition, he believes the study will give insight to how Alaska's glaciers respond to climate change.
We're going to be investigating how the glaciers in Denali Park advanced and retreated over the last 1,000 years as well. So we're going to have climate data from the ice cores, and then we're going to see how the glaciers responded by looking at where their positions moved through time. And so we'll be able to put those into our glacier models and our climate models and get a really good understanding of how these glaciers respond to climate change. And that will allow us to predict how much they're going to melt back in the future, and therefore how much they're going to contribute to global sea level rise.
The data analysis will take another 2 years, but afterwards the team hopes to have a much better understanding of what controls the climate in central Alaska. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scanning the bones of animals of the Arctic.
You can actually print these out on a 3D printer, and now you've got a physical surrogate of the actual item, rather than simply a digital one.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A pilot escaped injury after his helicopter crashed at a mine near Delta Junction. The crash happened last evening at the Pogo Mine. National Transportation Safety Board investigator Clint Johnson says the Hughes 500D was carrying a sling load when it went down just after 6 p.m. Monday. The aircraft is operated by Wasilla-based Saloy Helicopters. Johnson says the helicopter had an engine failure, landed in trees, and rolled over. The wreckage is being taken to Anchorage, where NTSB investigators can get a closer look. A 17-year-old boy was rescued by Alaska Air National Guardsmen yesterday. The teen, who suffered a leg injury while on a float trip down the Gulkana River, was picked up after the 11th Air Force Rescue Center at J-Bear received distress signals from a personal locator beacon and a spot beacon before 6 p.m. last night. Lieutenant Bernie Kale is a public affairs specialist with the Alaska Air National Guard. Kale says the injured boy was first discovered by a group of canoers on the river.
And they noticed a 17-year-old boy and his father on the side of the river. And they were out of the river. They were not in the water. And they looked like they were in distress. So the group of 10 individuals, they stopped. They checked on the 17-year-old boy. They found that he had a leg injury with some infection that had already taken place.
The canoe group then activated their personal locator beacons and their spot distress signal. Alaska State Troopers had also picked up the signals, but Kale says they were not able to respond to the emergency.
They were unsure of the weather, terrain, and then the injury, the extent of the injury on the 17-year-old. So they were not able to support the mission. And so the Rescue Coordination Center then activated the 210th, 211th, and 212th rescue squadrons from the Alaska Air National Guard.
Operators of an Air National Guard helicopter dispatched to the scene spotted the canoers waving their oars in the air about 25 miles from Glen Allen. Rescuers lowered from the helicopter, carried the injured boy to a spot suitable for a helicopter landing. Afterward, he and his father were hoisted into the helicopter and flown to Anchorage. Kale says the boy is at Providence Hospital. He says no names are being released at this time. A Yupik teenager has taken a gold medal in the Junior Olympics and is a world champion in martial arts. 13-year-old Michael Martinez has roots in the Yukon River village of Kotlik. From KYUK in Bethel, Sophie Ivan has the story.
The 2013 Junior Olympics were held in Detroit, Michigan earlier this month. On Friday, August 2nd, 13-year-old Martinez advanced in the heavy male karate division. He won first place and a gold medal, competing against athletes from around the world. Martinez has been training for 6 years now, since he was 7 years old, at the Okamoto School of Karate in Anchorage. Martinez says he has always been interested in the martial arts, starting when he was a child watching the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. He was motivated to learn karate after watching a karate demonstration in Anchorage. Martinez also won 3 world titles at the U.S. World Open Martial Arts Championships in July. In Bethel, I'm Sophie Ivan.
Federal prosecutors say they will not seek the death penalty against a Kodiak man charged in the fatal shootings of 2 men at a Coast Guard station on Kodiak Island. James Wells is awaiting a February 2014 trial for the fatal shootings of Coast Guardsman Petty Officer First Class James Hopkins and retired Chief Petty Officer Richard Belisle in April 2012. An assistant U.S. attorney informed the court in a filing yesterday of the decision to not seek the death penalty. The 62-year-old Wells faces 6 felony charges, 2 counts each of first-degree murder, murder of a U.S. officer, and use of a firearm in a violent crime. He has pleaded innocent to all the charges. In May, a federal judge denied bail for Wells. There is another delay in a jury trial for a man accused of killing his girlfriend at a Yakutat lodge long ago. The proceeding has been postponed again. As Matt Miller reports from KTOO in Juneau, the latest delay will allow the defense to review new evidence that stems from the original cold case.
The start of a jury trial in the case of Robert Dean Kowalski has been moved to the first full week in November. A previous start date of this month, August, was earlier set after previous delays and postponements. James Fayette from the Alaska Department of Law's Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals said during a recent hearing in Juneau Superior Court that another delay was necessary. He had just notified Kowalski's attorney about a batch of original evidence that his paralegal had just discovered. They include autopsy photos from the original case in 1996, an original witness list, weapons analysis from the crime lab, and the handwritten notes from the original state trooper investigator. Although it was not openly discussed in court, Fayette likely saved himself from a whole host of sanctions and discipline had he waited until later to reveal the existence of that evidence. It's already in the hands of Kowalski's public defender, Eric Hedlund, but since it amounts to a huge discovery dump on the eve of trial, Fayette proposed moving proceedings back at least several more months. He says a victim in the case did not have any objections to the November 4th start of the trial. Kowalski is being charged with the death of his girlfriend in July of 1996. Sandra Perry was 39 years old when she was reported killed during an accidental shooting at the Glacier Bear Lodge. Kowalski, who was 35 years old at the time, was never charged then for Perry's death. The prosecutor assigned to the case apparently determined that there was not enough evidence to disprove Kowalski's claim of an accident. Troopers say that a man staying in the next room at the lodge reported hearing an argument and then a gunshot followed by silence. Kowalski told troopers that he armed himself with a shotgun after he and Perry heard a bear outside of their room. Kowalski said he tripped onto the bed, fell on top of Perry, and the gun discharged when he got up. The Alaska Bureau of Investigation's Cold Case Unit reviewed the Yakutat incident after Kowalski was convicted in Montana of killing another girlfriend there, 45-year-old Lorraine K. Marin, in March of 2008. The Kalispell Daily Interlake newspaper in Montana reported that the incident involved the arrest of Kowalski after a 31-hour standoff at his home that involved SWAT teams from three jurisdictions. The gun used in the shooting was recovered from his home. Kowalski told investigators the gun accidentally went off as he was falling backward into a chair. Kowalski was sentenced to serve 40 years in prison for Marin's murder. After charges were filed in the Yakutat case in late 2011, Kowalski was extradited to Alaska. Now 52 years old, he's been held at the Cook Inlet Pretrial Facility and Lemon Creek Correctional Center with bail set at $1 million. He's serving his time for the Montana case while he awaits trial on first and second degree murder charges in the Alaska case. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Scientists from Idaho State University are at the University of Alaska Museum of the North in Fairbanks taking high-resolution images of animal bones. It's part of a National Science Foundation-funded project to create an online catalog of bones of every Arctic bird, fish, and mammal. KUAC's Dan Bross visited a museum laboratory to see how they're doing it.
That's the sound of a laser scanning camera at work. Idaho State University Virtualization Laboratory Assistant Manager Nicholas Clement uses the camera mounted on an articulating arm to scan a doll sheep backbone.
It's basically a measuring device that shoots a laser and triangulates space on the computer screen here. So as it's really basically pretty cut and dry, I run the laser over the surface. The computer extrapolates data from the scanner and produces a point cloud. And from here, we'll take this point cloud and we'll edit it and surface it and, you know, mesh it out. And then we'll take the photographs that are being done over here and we'll put the photographs back on the surface so that we're full color and we look very, very much like the actual object did in real life.
The result is a super high resolution image, accurate down to a fifth the size of a human hair. Many of the individual bone specimens being scanned at the Museum of the North are part of entire skeletons. Virtualization lab manager Robert Schlater says once rendered on a computer, the bone images can almost be brought to life.
So you can reassemble an animal, put all its bones back where it's supposed to be, and then animate it as it would move in life, and now you can see how all the bones are moving together, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's nice. One thing that we haven't been doing a lot but every single model we've ever produced can't be used for it, is you can actually print these out on a 3D printer. And now you've got a physical surrogate of the actual item rather than simply a digital one.
Having precise computer images of rare animal bones means researchers don't have to travel to places like the University of Alaska's Museum of the North to see them. Mammal collection manager Aaron Gunderson points to another valuable aspect of the project.
Well, it will require us to handle things less often. And damage to specimens occurs when you're pulling them out of drawers, packaging them, shipping them.
Gunderson says that's especially important at the Museum of the North, which houses one of the best marine mammal collections.
The second largest collection of marine mammals in North America, second to the Smithsonian.
The collection includes whale skeletons partially displayed in the museum's exhibit area.
So what are we looking at here?
This is the gray whale skull right next to the larger bowhead whale skull.
And how will this be scanned? This is so big. They can't do what they're doing in the other room, right?
No. Well, they will use that movable arm laser that they were using, and we have the whole skeleton for this that belongs with this skull, and we'll be bringing that. It's off-site. We'll be bringing that here for them to scan every bone in the bowhead whale.
The whale skeletons are among a dozen Arctic bird, fish, and mammal specimens to be scanned, a three-week project that includes imaging of hundreds of individual bones. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
A Matanuska Susitna Borough teacher has filed as a candidate for lieutenant governor. Bob Williams, a former Teacher of the Year, says he'll support education funding. Williams, from Palmer, has a background in petroleum engineering as well as in education. He is on record as opposing the Parnell administration's oil tax cuts. Williams currently teaches at Colony High School in Palmer. The U.S. Coast Guard is 223 years old. The Maritime Service was created on August 4, 1790, as the Revenue Cutter Service under the U.S. Department of Treasury. Juneau is headquarters of the 17th Coast Guard District, which includes the Arctic. A weekend celebration in Juneau included a visit by the heavy icebreaker Polar Star on its way to its Seattle home port after conducting ice tests in the Bering Sea. The ship has been rebuilt and is the Coast Guard's only heavy icebreaker in operation. The Polar Star was open to visitors on Saturday. Polar Star Executive Officer Kenneth Boda was one of the tour guides and offered a Coast Guard history lesson.
We were built to basically collect customs and taxes, collect tariffs of vessels coming into the port. Over the years, we absorbed the Lighthouse Service and the Life-Saving Service, the Bureau of Steamboat Inspections as well.
The modern Coast Guard was created in 1915 as the 5th Military Uniformed Service. Most coastal Alaskans are familiar with the Coast Guard missions of safety, security, and stewardship.
Saving people's lives. That's one of the big responsibilities of the Coast Guard. Making sure that the ships that leave port are safe. We do vessel inspections. Making sure that foreign ships that arrive have been inspected and have cleared all of the U.S. regulations before they come into U.S. ports.
In 2012, according to the Coast Guard website, more than 436,000 vessels and their 29.5 million crew members and passengers were screened prior to arrival in U.S. ports. The Coast Guard is the only military organization within the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Boda says that means it is responsible for ensuring U.S. harbors and ports are secure from any kind of threat.
When I say threats, people think terrorist threats, but it's not always terrorism that's a threat. Sometimes just a hazard to navigation. For instance, a vessel that might wander out of the shipping lane and lose situational awareness. In some other ports like Valdez, for instance, we have a vessel traffic service, you know, that basically monitors shipping as they come in and out and make sure everyone's safe.
While enforcing U.S. fisheries laws is one of the most visible roles of the Coast Guard in Alaska, stewardship is protecting the oceans.
Stewardship is environmental pollution response. So that's why the Coast Guard's called out to an Exxon Valdez or a Deepwater Horizon as well.
The Coast Guard is still investigating Royal Dutch Shell's 2012 Alaska drilling operations after some vessels failed inspections. The oil rig Kulik ran aground, and the company had other safety and environmental violations. The new mountain bike trails at Anchorage's Kincaid Park are now ready to go. Volunteers got started on Monday night helping to carve out 6 miles of new single-track trails on the north side of the park. Lee Bowling, vice president of Single Track Advocates, says the process should go through September.
We're still kind of at the very beginning of the project right now. The machinery goes through and makes the kind of the rough cut, and then the volunteer crews come through and get all the little roots that are sticking up out of the way and work on some of the drainage and packing in the trails and the berms.
And the single-track mountain biking is becoming very popular in Anchorage.
The volunteer part is a very important part, and we hope we can get as many people out there as possible.
It appears that they will have success with that.
You know, we did the Hillside Trails in 2008, and that was a big hit. And then when we did the trails in Kincaid for phase one in 2011, that was another big hit. And people just are getting more and more excited about these trails. And I think everyone's just having so much fun riding them that they want more.
Some residents are concerned that single-track biking can disturb wildlife or other trail users. But Bowling says they're taking that into consideration.
We've been working with Jesse Coltrane with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And we're trying to build this new section of trail so that you have better sight distances, you can really see where you're going to try and minimize conflicts with other users that are out there and also with, you know, moose that are out there as well.
Volunteer trail building crews will meet at the Raspberry parking lot in Kincaid Park on Mondays and Wednesdays at 6 p.m. until the trails are done this fall. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Sophie Ivan in Bethel, Matt Miller and Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Sarah Bernard from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Crowley, committed to Alaska for nearly 60 years. From basketball games to sled dog races, Crowley supports events that bring Alaskans together. Crowley supports what matters, and public radio matters. cpdalaska.com. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.